If you'd like to open your Bible to 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, we'll be reading from that in just a moment. As you turn there, let me take a moment to say I appreciate so much your presence. It is good to be here. Mike noted we've got a long list of folks who are out sick, and there are probably some out sick that we're not aware of, maybe some traveling, but we've got a good crowd. We've got a number of visitors. We appreciate the presence of all. And I want to encourage you to think with me this morning. My lesson this morning is entitled, It's a Wonderful Life. Y'all may have heard there's a movie by that name. I recently had the opportunity, Janet and I got to watch that movie again. And yes, at the very end of it, I had tears in my eyes. I think there was dust, you know, in the theater. But I don't know how many of you have ever seen the movie. But I'll tell you this about it. Like anything that Hollywood puts out, there will be parts of it you say, man, I wish they didn't have that in there. The movie takes a very approving look at the consumption of alcohol. There's a little drinking in it. Their theology of angels, I would certainly question. I don't know that, you know, angels have to earn their wings or anything like that. But the movie and its theme is just a powerful, encouraging thought. The story is of George Bailey, the man who had all these great dreams, these aspirations of greatness. You know, as soon as he could get out of high school, he was leaving town. He was going to explore the world. He was going to, you know, make a difference in this world. And he was going to be somebody great. And, you know, if you've ever seen the movie, because of his father's death, he has to stay in Bedford Falls. He has to manage, as he says, the crummy old savings and loan or the building and loan. And he just doesn't have the life that he wanted. And some things happened and he was ready to commit suicide. And then through the marvels of, you know, his guardian angel named Clarence, he was able to see that had he not lived, the world would have been a horribly different place. Well, you know, as I say, it's all make-believe. But one of the things that movie teaches is a biblical principle. What the world sees as ordinary people, working ordinary jobs, sometimes make a very great difference in the lives of others. I ask you to turn to 1 Corinthians 12 because I think in the very first century, in the beginning years of the church, there were those that had the idea that, you know, in order to be somebody in the church, you had to possess certain gifts. There were people who felt like they were nobodies. There were those that were looked down upon as nobodies. Begin reading with me at verse 14. He says, for in fact, the body is not one member, but many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? I mean, can you just imagine the human body having an argument about, well, I don't really think I need you. I'm more important than you. No. Verse 17, if the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where would be the smelling? But now God has set the members, each one of them, in the body, just as he pleased. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? But now indeed there are many members, yet one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. No, much rather, those members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. He goes on with this discussion, but his point is, we look at things sometimes too superficially. In the church, sometimes some of the most valuable members are people doing work that is behind the scenes. In the human body, the parts that, you know, we often judge people by their outward appearance. Oh, a beautiful face. Well, there's nothing wrong with having a beautiful face. But it's far more important to have a heart that's good, to have, you know, lungs that are functioning properly, and yet those are never seen. In our human body, we see that. In the church, it's the same way. Think about what may have seemed the absurdity of the words of Jesus in Matthew 5, in verse 13, when to his disciples he says, "You are the salt of the earth." These guys that have spent their lives being fishermen, you know, one, he was a white collar, he was a tax collector, hated by most. He said, "You are the salt of the earth." Now he warns them about losing the flavor. Then he says, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." I would offer to you, when Jesus first said those words, people shook their head. Those guys aren't anybody. They're nobodies. God's people are what this world needs. I'm not saying we don't need, you know, some of the people that hold positions of honor in this world and do these great things. But folks who live godly lives, who are, you know, living by the standards, you know, the best they can of the New Testament, loving their neighbor as themselves, serving God, they are people that make a difference in this world. Christians are important. What I want to do in this lesson is look at some people that, and I'm a little behind there, that may not have seemed like great people of the Bible. You know, we have the great Bible characters that we all know. But remember, Jesus said that greatness is in being a servant, Matthew 20. I'm going to look at some people today that are not as well known and suggest some applications in our lives. And I want to start with two people that I hope you know who they are, Amram and Jochebed. You know, when it comes to great characters of the Bible, there's nobody that doesn't recognize Moses as one of those great characters. I mean, he's the great lawgiver. He's the one that God used to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. He is the one that appears with Jesus and Elijah on the Mount of Transfiguration. And yet, Moses never should have reached adulthood. Exodus 1, the Pharaoh had given the orders that the male babies are to be cast into the river. Moses should have died shortly after childbirth. But look at Hebrews, the 11th chapter. What is said about his parents? Verse 23, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command." They didn't let the orders of the king stop them from saving the life of their child. They took care of him. They hid him for 3 months. At the end of the 3 months, when they couldn't hide him anymore, you know the story. His mother makes the little basket. She puts Moses in it. And she puts it in the right place. You know, and leaves Miriam there. We'll say more about her later. But here is Moses. That nobody doubts the greatness of Moses. But without courageous parents, there is no Moses. Ephesians 6:4 says, "And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord." If we, as parents, those of you who are still rearing your children, if you can raise up godly children who will become that salt of the earth, that light of the world, you will have contributed something great to your community, to the church. You know, but let me say this. You know what it said here about Amram and Jochebed? It said they were not afraid of the king's command. I don't think we, when we're thinking about parenting, we think about courage enough. But it takes a certain amount of courage to be a godly parent. You can't be afraid, not today, of the king's command, but you can't be afraid of what the world's going to think. Because the world doesn't think that you ought to discipline your children. The world doesn't think that you ought to ever say no to them. The world doesn't think that you ought to keep your children from, you know, the places that, well, this is where everybody's going, whether it be the clubs, the dances, to the beaches, you know, the various places. And more than that, and I'm sure, you know, I look out here and I see these young people, I know that they would never do this, but sometimes children don't appreciate the efforts of their parents. When parents are doing what they can and what they believe best to bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord, sometimes the children themselves, they resist that. And I would offer this, you know, maybe as parents, it's sometimes good for us to stop and say, why are they resisting? Could it be that I'm not doing the right thing? Because sometimes as parents, we can be wrong. But if we're doing the right thing, we've got to have the courage to keep going. You know, I'm not saying that as a Christian, your only job is to be a good parent and raise up godly children. But I am telling you, don't undervalue the contribution you are making to the future of God's church, the community as a whole. You know, we often lament what the world's becoming. And we talk about how bad things are. Well, we can't stop all of that. But we have the power, just us ordinary people, to make sure there's still some salt in this earth. There's still some lights that are shining. You remember God saying to Abraham that if there were just 10 righteous souls in Sodom, he would spare that city? Well, I don't know how many God's looking for in this country, but we can give it a few more. And we don't have to have a second Moses at our feet. We don't. But I think in my life, if somehow I could look back from the grave 25 years after I'm gone, and people would say, you know, John did some good things, appreciate the work he did. But you know, his children sure have done more than he did. I think that'd be a great thing for somebody to say. You know, I don't know if Amram and Jochebed, I kind of doubt they lived to see Moses deliver the people. But I believe if they could have, they would have been happy to see that these two, you know, this child they've raised up, and Aaron, their son that was the high priest, had exceeded them. And I'm talking about parents. I'll slide it over a little bit. Lois and Eunice. Lois and Eunice instilled faith in Timothy under less than ideal conditions. And let's make sure we see this. 2 Timothy 1:5, Paul writes of, when I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded is in you also. There's no doubt but what he is connecting the faith of Timothy to that of the grandmother and the mother. It was first there in your grandmother and your mother. And I'm convinced, he said, I know your faith is genuine. It's your real faith. In the third chapter, he would say of Timothy that from childhood, verse 15, you have known the Holy Scriptures. I say less than ideal circumstances. Timothy's father evidently was an unbeliever. Acts 16 speaks of him as a Greek. And Timothy had never been circumcised, as was the law for a Jewish child. But his mother and his grandmother made sure he knew. I'm turning over to Philippians, the second chapter. In verse 19, Paul writes to the church at Philippi and says, "But I trust in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you shortly, that I also may be encouraged when I know your state. For I have no one like-minded who will sincerely care for your state. For all seek their own, not the things which are of Christ Jesus. But you know his proven character, that as a son with his father, he has served with me in the gospel." People who know anything at all about the New Testament, they look at the Apostle Paul, and sometimes we look at him with awe. Sometimes I think we even forget he was human just like we are, but almost certainly did more to spread the gospel around the Mediterranean than any other human did. He wrote 13 of our 27 New Testament books. One of the men that helped him immensely in his work was Timothy. Paul said, "I've got Timothy. He serves with me like a son in the gospel. I can send him on this mission and trust he'll get the job done." What I'm saying is, if we were back it up and we take Timothy out of the picture, then the work of Paul looks a little different. But why is Timothy in the picture? It's because of Lois and Eunice. Parents, grandparents, do what you can, all you can, to bring up children who love the Lord, who will serve Him, and they will make a difference. And you will have made a difference. What about Miriam? You ever think about that story there in Exodus, the second chapter, and how it could have been different? We don't know exactly how old Miriam was. You know, we would assume that she had to be at least 8 to 9 years old for the conversation that's carried on. But her mother put her in charge of watching the little basket. And when Pharaoh's daughter opens the basket, his sister, verse 7, goes to Pharaoh's daughter and says, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. Moses is nursed and cared for in the first 2, 3, in that culture it could have been as much as 4 years of his life, by his own mother, because his sister stood there and kept watch. And say, okay, but what if she had walked off? What if she had gotten distracted? What if she just went off and played? And she goes somewhere else, takes that baby somewhere else. What Miriam did that day, think about it. It didn't take any kind of special talent. It didn't take any particular courage, because, you know, she's not trying to defy any kind of orders. Just, hey, would you, I mean, I can tell you, like this baby? Would you like me to find you a Hebrew nurse for it? But something I've observed over the years, and this is, you know, my own observation, but I believe it's true, is that sometimes jobs that require the least amount of talent, the kind of jobs that just about anybody could do, sometimes get neglected. You know, the old anybody could do it, and ends up nobody doing it. You know, that it doesn't take special talent. There are things that require special abilities. But how much talent? How gifted do you have to be to go to the hospital and sit during a surgery? Or to go by and visit somebody? Or to pick up the phone and call them? To send a card? Fix a meal? Maybe, okay, a little talent involved in that, but, you know, you can't always pick up something at a restaurant and take it to them if you don't have that talent. You know, it doesn't take a lot of ability. But those things make differences in the lives of people. Sometimes what we do for somebody, that makes a difference in their life. And that life may impact others. Somebody is a visitor here. Particularly someone who comes in who is not a Christian. The greeting of that visitor may well impact on whether or not they will end up being receptive to the gospel. And of course, your word of greeting, it might make a difference in that life. But then just think about kind of a chain here. If that person becomes a Christian, how many lives might that person impact? Conversely, if that person does not feel welcome, and they end up not obeying the gospel, how many lives are impacted in a negative way? It doesn't take a lot to invite somebody. Use what we have. I want to continue this thought in 2 Kings, the 5th chapter. This one goes right along with this, not necessarily special talent, but you never know what you might do. 2 Kings, the 5th chapter, is the story of Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper. Now, most of you would know the story of Naaman. Naaman ends up going to the house of Elisha, the prophet in Israel, being told by Elisha, if you'll go dip in the Jordan 7 times, you'll be cleansed. And Naaman didn't like those instructions, had to be talked into doing it by his servants. And then when he did it, he was cleansed, and he said, I'll not worship any other god except the Lord, the God of Israel. It is a great chapter to teach us the importance of doing things exactly the way God says it. It is a great warning against preconceived ideas, because Naaman, he already had it all worked out in his mind. This is the way it's going to be. And it wasn't that way, and it bothered him. But what I want to go back to is, what set it all in motion? Verse 2, and the Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife. Then she said to her mistress, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy. Naaman learned about the Lord. His servants learned about the Lord. I don't know how many other people learned about the Lord. Why? Because a young girl who's been taken captive, who's been enslaved, said the prophet could help him. Now, I don't know that she ever thought it would happen. But I want us to realize, the words we use make a difference. The things we say, you know, sometimes we maybe teach full lessons, but sometimes all we say is just a word that points somebody in the right direction. Sometimes we just point them toward the knowledge of God. Maybe sometimes just the right word is what it takes. We don't realize. I mean, let me just backstop for a second. We need to be as attuned to people's thoughts and feelings as we can be. We need to be aware when people are getting discouraged and they are slipping in their faith, if possible. But people often wear masks. And we don't see that. But our kind word, our word of appreciation, our word of encouragement, it might well be the thing that keeps them going. And we never know about it. We never realize it. In the movie, you know, he had no idea the impact he'd had on that town, on the people of it. A lot of the things we do, we may not ever realize that some word we spoke provided the encouragement for that one person to keep going. And that one person that kept going, well, then that made a difference in the life of his child. Or, you know, on and on. Look at a few passages with me. Proverbs 16, verse 24. Pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the bones. I mean, that servant girl, she couldn't heal him of the leprosy. She couldn't do anything for him. But she knew somebody that could, and her words made a difference. The 25th chapter of Proverbs, in verse 11, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and settings of silver. A word fitly spoken. Just a little more thought to what I'm saying, why I'm saying it. The next verse is interesting. Like an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold is a wise rebuker to an obedient ear. Words fitly spoken. Pleasant words. He speaks of those, but he also speaks of wise rebuke. Sometimes we need to sound a warning to people. Sometimes we need to speak some strong words to people. But even then, it must be done with wisdom. In the 31st chapter, when we're reading about this virtuous wife, this wife that's so hardworking and caring for her children and making sure they're not afraid of the snow because they're dressed warmly. Verse 26 says she opens her mouth with wisdom and on her tongue is the law of kindness. As a people, as an individual, if our words are words of kindness, if they are words that speak of the Lord, that speak of His mercy, His ability to deliver, if we have a love for others so that we speak those words to more people, we just don't know what we might do. We don't know what we might set in motion. As I said, I don't think for a moment that young servant girl, when she said it, expected it to take off the way it did. But say those things that need to be said. It can make a real difference. Turn to Romans 16 with me. I mentioned Timothy earlier, but I want to think about some of Paul's associates again. I'm not going to go through all of them, but we use the expression sometimes playing second fiddle to somebody. Some of the people listed in Romans 16, they weren't even in the band. I mean, and yet, when you stop and you measure the greatness of Paul and his contribution, without these people, things are diminished. I mean, I think sometimes we might think about Timothy's and Silas, a Luke, you know, some of those that were the preachers that were a little more public. But there's Aquila and Priscilla. He mentions them in verse 3, and he says in verse 4, and this is one of those, we don't know any details about this, but they risk their own necks for his life. He said, I give thanks for them, and all the churches of the Gentiles do too. I look at these two people. I am confident, based on what the New Testament says, that Priscilla never preached a sermon. And if Aquila ever preached one, there's no record of it. But these people, they were faithful to the Lord when they lived in Corinth, when they lived in Ephesus, when they lived in Rome. They risked their neck for Paul. I don't know what that involved. But somewhere along the line, they did something that could have cost them their life to save his. They made a difference. By making a difference in Paul's life, they made a difference in the lives of countless other people. Chapter 16 and verse 22. There's no chapter 22. I, Tertius, who wrote this epistle, greet you in the Lord. We can read from elsewhere that Paul typically did not do his own writing. He would append a little note at the end of the epistle in his own handwriting. But typically he had someone to take the dictation for him. This is the only time we know the name of the fellow. How much talent did it take to be Tertius? All he had to do was be able to write legibly. That would have ruled me out, but most people, and Eric, but most people could have done the job of Tertius. But I say again, oftentimes jobs just anybody could do. Nobody does. Do that job. How about Paul's nephew in Acts, the 23rd chapter? There was a plot against Paul's life. Paul's nephew. I don't know what age he was, but he's referred to as a lad. He wasn't going to be able to stop a band of 40 men that had taken this oath to kill Paul. But he went to Paul in the barracks and told him about it. And then Paul had the centurion take him to the commander. Now, I understand when I deal with Bible characters, there is the plan and the providence of God. And I don't want anybody to overlook that. But if those 40 men had been allowed to succeed in their plot, then think about all the letters we're missing. Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, Philemon, 1st, 2nd Timothy, Titus. You know, all the things God used a nephew of Paul, and we're not ever even told his name. Just a lad. But he knew of something. He did something. The point I'm wanting us to understand about all of this is, if you can't do great things, just do what you can do. And it's also this, I want you to look around and I want you to realize that your brethren may be doing a whole lot more than you realize. Impacting lives. We talk about movers and shakers. And we talk about people of influence and power. And there are those that whose influence is more easily measured and seen. But godly lives make a difference. In Mark the 14th chapter, this will be my closing text. You remember Mary, the sister of Martha, sister of Lazarus. She has come to Jesus in that last week, and she has anointed him with this costly oil. And Jesus rebukes the disciples because they were criticizing her. And his word was in verse 8, she has done what she could. You know, most of us, you know, there may be some exceptions in this room, but most of us, when we depart from this life, there'll be no mention of it on the nightly news. You know, CNN and Fox and all the others, they won't stop to do a special about us. But if we're living for the Lord, and we're speaking those words of kindness, and we're trying our best to raise up godly children in this world, we're far more important to this world and to the cause of Christ than most would ever recognize. The lesson's titled, It's a Wonderful Life. Well, part of what that was all about in the movie was the realization at the very end that others appreciated him more than he thought. But one of the things we learn from Christ is you don't live your life for the appreciation of others. You live it to please him and to please God. You live a life that's pleasing to God. It will make a difference in the lives of others. And it will be a great life. Because it will result in the afterlife. Let's be busy just being children of God in this world. Let's not fret about what the world thinks of us. Let's be focused on being the light that world needs. They may not recognize it, but we'll be that anyway. But to have the good life, you have to be in Christ. If you've never been baptized into Christ, why don't you make that happen today? If you've turned away from Christ, maybe something along the line, you've just become discouraged. You're ready to give up. And you've not been faithful to your God. I hope you come back to Him today. If we can help you, you come as we stand and sing together.